Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 1st of April 2012. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I am joined by Web Cowgirl, Glenn Pierce, Rev Stan, and Julie Raby. Now, this play has just closed, but I think it's worth talking about it. This is Sound and Fury's Going Dark, written by Hattie Naylor. This play was being done at the Clare Space at the Young Vic. You led round the back, and it tells the tale of an astronomer gradually with a degenerative degenerative blindness, and was really quite it performed almost in the pitch dark. I mean, there are times when there is no light, there are no lights at all anywhere on this play, and it's really quite effective in places. Now, it's probably worth talking about this because Sound of Fury, whose last big work was Kursk, that came back several times, and hopefully this will be returning at some point, either in the same place or somewhere else. Now, Web Cowgirl, what did you think about this play?
I'll admit, I went to see it substantially because I'd enjoyed Kursk so much. Although, you know, that was, I thought, not perfect show. But a lot of the reason why I went to see it was because of also the geekiness factor. Because it was billed a bit about being a play that was about astronomy and a play that sort of takes part, you know, to some extent, inside a planetarium. And I thought, well, what a wonderful opportunity to see a show, in which we learn something, you know, about the universe. And I was actually kind of thinking we were going to be talked to more about man's place among the stars and just sort of things like that, but it was really so much about the human experience of losing your sight and the impact that it has on you. And they make you aware of your own eyes very, very early on when the guy is, quote, at work, and we're all tilted with our heads up looking at the ceiling of the space where he says, now, if you look straight ahead, you can't see the Crab Nebula there next to Orion's Belt. But if you look a bit to the side, then you can see it. So we are made aware of our own peripheral vision and, you know, what you can do to activate it. And this is followed almost immediately by something that was of him taking an eye test. And this kind of experience is something I've never had in a play where you're basically going through a medical procedure with the character. So we can see these little red dots appearing on the top of the walls. We can hear him making the beeping noise when he sees them, and then we can see that the ones that are off on the side aren't registering for him. So we become aware that he is losing his sight before the character figures it out. And I found that very moving, and I have to say this was one of those rare plays where I actually lost the boundary between the character as it was written on the page and the reality of human beings with their, you know, forward lives and their past lives. And I wound up sitting there thinking about what his childhood had been like, you know, where his son had come from, what had happened to his mother, because she's, I think, really never mentioned at all. And the fact that this show, which, you know, perhaps wasn't perfect, managed to get to that point where it created a reality that I found that compelling. I found it really very moving. And I have to say, I walked out of it a little stunned. how embarrassing. And my friend who found the whole story of experiencing going blind just so intense. He was actually almost traumatized by watching this happen. It was there's a bit where the entire room is completely pitch black, and you can hear the voiceover of the announcers at the tube, and then you can hear the tap, 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 as if of a cane on cement bouncing off of the tight walls of the tunnels. And you realize this pitch blackness with nothing but these voices, that's the reality of being blind. And I just, I thought it was the most intense way possible to really get that message across. So, the story itself was somewhat trivial insofar as there was a story, but the experience that they put you through as an audience member, even though we just sat the whole time with our heads mostly craning up and occasionally trying to look over the people in front of us, you know, it was, I really enjoyed it. But I know you didn't feel this, I know you found it not quite as good as I did.
Yeah, I don't think I got really as involved in it as you did. I mean, it has to be said, John McKay, who is the only performer we see, it was very effective and very, very good in this. I wasn't taken out of it. There is a certain there is a certain problem I have with some artistic depictions of science. Most scientists I know aren't that enthusiastic. Although I suppose if you're trying to popularise science, the you do that, but they tend not to think about it. It's sort of almost an artistic render. It's almost what the artist, you know, when they find out about science, they get all enthused about it. But scientists tend to be not quite as enthusiastic about it, and I don't necessarily think that they. I don't really believe they talk in that way. They talk in a much drier way, unless they're sort of presenting a television program where they've got to be, you know, enthusiastic and show wonder. And he was much more along those lines than a sort of a rather dry scientist that you would expect. And so it slightly took me out of it and stopped me believing in him as a scientist. But I did think, I mean, there are other things like the we haven't mentioned. You have a small child, his son, who we hear occasionally. And I seem to recall listening to an interview with the Sound and Fury where they said it was actually sort of unforced. They pretty much, you know, set the child off to talk about things and just recorded it and just recorded him and then cut him in. Wrote the play around him, so you've got the reactions and what he says. So that I found very deep. I mean, there were other things like as you say, the not knowing where the wife was and what had happened, and never really understanding that, and also where his pride came from, because a lot of his problems come from the fact that he doesn't want anybody to help. And where is that, you know, where's that coming from? So, you know, it was just slightly unanswered questions, but it was a very effective show, I think. Very impressive.
Well, I would definitely recommend it to people if it comes back. And I enjoyed the intimacy of the space quite a bit. You walk into the room and it's almost completely dark inside there already. You're not allowed to bring in any bags. You're not allowed to put anything underneath your chair. And they ask you to leave your cell phones outside of the room too. That all helped to create an atmosphere in which, you know, what little light there was inside the room became that much more intense. I think I enjoyed this play more than, you know, so many shows done on such a bigger scale. I thought it was just a really good experience. So, you know, I guess you wouldn't disagree that it'd be great to have it come back there, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it needs to come back at some point. It'd be, you know, very worthwhile. Now, I have to admit, I haven't actually read Master Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's actually on a stack of books that I keep, which I mean to read. Now, this is an adaptation of Master Margarita by Theatre to Complicity, although they call themselves Complicity these days. It's directed by Simon McBurney and stars, well, the names that jump out at you, Paul Rees, who I haven't seen for quite a number of years now, and it's good to see him back. Sinead Matthews, Angus Wright, and Tim McMullen. They are all very, very effective in this play, and I didn't, although it's lasted 3 hours, I didn't actually feel a lot of that. It really worked quite well, and I was really glad to see this piece of epic theatre done on the Barbican's main stage. I haven't seen an awful lot of really effective modern sort of big theatre, and this was one of them, or one that really worked, and I thought this worked particularly well. I came to it completely clean. Now, you know the book, don't you, Webcow Girl?
Pardon me. Yes, I've also, so I saw the play, I saw it done as a play. That was my first exposure to it about 10 years ago. And, give me a second, I'm going to cough again. But I went and read the book about 2 years back, remembering, you know, its reputation as being, you know, a masterpiece of 20th century literature. And I have to say, you know, the book itself is really amazing, but it's hard to look at it and see really how it could be adapted. It's you've got so many storylines happening at the same time. You know, Christ's encounter with Pilate, the devil coming to Moscow and raising a lot of trouble in the literary circles. And this story that sort of comes out of nowhere about this author called the Master and his lover Margarita and her attempts to find him after he's taken away for harboring subversive literature in his flat. And underneath all of this fantastical stuff is what reads to me as a very harsh reality of what life was like in the Soviet Union during the 30s. And so, you know, while we've got these, you know, comedy moments of people being turned into pigs and the devil showing up at a theatrical production and causing the members of the audience to be stripped naked and, you know, all of these basically sort of magical realism elements. Underneath it, there's people who are fighting desperately to get bread coupons, who are being careful to not speak about things that are not permitted by the authorities. People who are so desperate or greedy to get into better accommodations that they would accuse their neighbors of a political crime in order to get their apartments. And that, I think, that underpinning reality that's made clear by the fantastical story is, I think, one of the most amazing accomplishments of the Master and Margarita. And I think Complicité did a very nice job of sifting through the story to figure out what elements they wanted to keep in order to preserve narrative and yet still not losing that intense flavor of the rise of Stalinism in the Soviet Union and what that meant for the freedom of the human spirit.
Yeah, I can see the. I certainly saw the elements of the Soviet, the Soviet oppression. There is also a part of the story. I mean, in the love story, has echoes of Bulgakov's own marriage to a, because he formed a relationship. His final relationship was with a woman who left her husband, I believe. So it was sort of that had a hint of autobiography about it. I thought it did, but it was. I mean, it did tell things very effectively. There has been criticized in some places that they have about four. There are about four endings to this play because they have to tie up all the loose ends, or they want to give closure to about four of the stories. So you think it's ended, and then there's another ending, and then there's another ending, and then there's another ending. Now, I didn't mind that at all because I was engrossed in it and really following on the plays. But there has been that criticism of it.
It's funny. I felt the last 20 minutes of the play were kind of the ones that I actually felt, and it may have been, although I didn't think about it at the time, because of this incongruity between these different storylines winding themselves up. But I certainly wanted to know what was going to happen, and I felt that at the end of this rendition, I had a much clearer feeling about how the different stories had actually intertwined than I did when I read the book, which just jumped back and forth from one thing to another, very, higgledy-piggledy. I think I'd like to talk about a little bit about the stagecraft of this show, because this was about 95% exactly what I hope to experience on the stage, which is almost as little as possible being used as props, etc., and seriously allowing the human imagination to come to the fore, because we can build grander palaces in our head than any set that can be built on a stage. If you're going to be switching back and forth between Pilate's garden and all of its roses, and then the room of the insane asylum, and then a scene where Margarita is hosting all the damned at a devil's ball while she's completely naked and dressed in blue paint. If you're actually trying to roll big sets back and forth, you would be struggling a lot. And I like that Complicité kind of handled most of this through the bare minimum that, the ballroom was essentially, as my recollection stands, a door. The artist's room was achieved with a bed and, an outline of where the walls would have been. The only thing that I found pretty irritating is when they had over-enthusiastic projected images on the back of the stage, because I actually find that when you start getting into, like, moving projections, that you wind up losing your focus on the actors, and it's more like watching TV. But mostly they displayed, I think, an admirable restraint.
I did think the projections work really quite well when they did the flying sequences. Where Sinead Matthews has to fly around. And there were one or two other places where, they would have people, essentially what they did was have people lying down on the stage and have a camera above them. So it did really make some of the flying through Moscow work, which is a big part of the piece, isn't it? Where she rushes around attacking the master's enemies. You're always a bit worried when they overdo projections, but I don't think, as you say, I don't think they did that here. It was very skillful, and I'm one of these people who, I don't mind not having any sets, because it can just be just give me the acting is what I always think. I just want to see an actor act, and they can create the pictures for me. I don't need sort of big sets to be dragged in, which I always feel is a bit of an insult to all these hardworking set designers, but what can you do?
I don't like to have it all spelled out for me. Say for Time in the Conways, having a lovely set to be a building, in the teens is enjoyable. Frankly, I think I'd like to spend a little bit more time trying to listen to the actors and hear the world they're creating with their words, rather than just, have it laid out there in front of me as if I don't have any imagination. So I thought this was the thing that kind of says what the quality of this piece is ultimately as a work of art, is the fact that I sat through an hour and 45 minutes without wanting to get up, without becoming bored, without doing anything other than readjusting myself to lean a little further forward or a little further to the side, as I had the 14-pound seats up in the rakiest part of the balcony. And when that interval came, I thought, wow, I'm going to have some ice cream, and I'm going to get right back in there and watch the rest of that show. And if you know how easy it is to lose me at even, say, the 20-minute point of a show, I think, hats off to Complicité. They actually did a very impressive job of making this work as a theatrical presentation.
After a sellout run both at the West, at the National Theatre and in the West End, One Man, Two Governors has now moved to the Theatre Royal Haymarket, where it has got a new cast. This is One Man, Two Governors is Richard Bean's take on Baldoni's Servant of Two Masters, and was, as I say, a big hit in at the National Theatre, where James Corden led the cast. Now this has been almost completely recast. I can't see too many names that I can remember from the first production. Glenn, what did you think about this new production of it?
It's strange, because with a farce, if you've seen it once, it's normally slightly spoilt on the second viewing, because you know the jokes that are coming, that's coming. But if anything, I think this cast works better than the original. Owen Arthur, who was originally James Corden's understudy in the original production, has had that rare step. He's been promoted from understudy into leading man slot, and it's a masterstroke. He, in a way, surpasses Corden's original production. I think when watching the original, which I saw at the National, I didn't see it at the Adelphi, you were in some ways aware that you were watching James Corden doing a very good, but you were aware he was doing a comedy routine, and he never fully escaped from sort of the James Corden TV stage personality that sort of everyone knows, and sort of that cheeky chappy. Owen Arthur really makes the part his own. He plays it in his natural Welsh lilt, rather than sort of Corden's sort of Essex estuary English, and it's just as funny, if not funnier than that, the National. This slapstick is still hilarious, even though you know what's coming. The asides to the audience still work, and I think it's a much stronger company as a whole. You aren't focused on, even though Owen Arthur's performance is, mesmerising, it's really well done, you're not focusing on one solo performance that you perhaps were watching James Corden. The whole supporting company really work well. You've got Jodie Prenger, renowned, perhaps best known for her, reality TV casting for Oliver. She's playing Dolly in the show. Again, really works well doing comedy, perhaps something you're not expecting her to do. You're expecting her sort of more of a musical theatre actress. Hannah Spirit as the wonderfully dumb and dizzy Pauline really works well. And there's some really great performances throughout the company. I loved it the second time round. The audience around me were loving it. I think, if they continue casting it to this level, I think it's got a long, long run ahead of it.
Rev Stan, you saw it as well. What did you think?
Yes. Now, I agree. I think it works really, really well with the new cast. I must admit that the first 20 minutes I found a little bit too hammy for my taste, but it seemed to settle into... They seem to settle into it a little bit more. I mean, it's fast, so it's going to be a bit hammy, but it was just a bit too hammy for me. I couldn't stop drawing parallels with the original cast. And although everybody was really good, it took me a while to get over missing the sort of the star quality that the first cast had. I'm not just talking about James Corden, but the likes of Oliver Chris, who I absolutely love, and I did miss people like him a little bit. But the cast were really, really good. And one of the things that I liked about seeing it a second time is you can sort of, because you've seen all the physical jokes and you know what's coming up, you can sort of put that to one side and actually concentrate on the script and what people are saying a little bit more. And it was far wittier than I remembered it. I'm not a massive fan of farce, and I did have a few problems with the original production, but I could sort of put that to one side a little bit and concentrate on actually how good the script was and on what people were actually saying. So yes, very, very good, very worthy. You always worry about new casts for productions that have done really, really well, but I think this is going to do very well, and it is definitely worthwhile a look if you haven't seen the original. And even if you have seen the original and fancy seeing it again, then definitely worth going back to see.
The Duchess of Malfi by John Webster is based on a real event, apparently, or loosely based on a real event, about a duchess called Giovanna de Aragona, and she was locked away, and she did actually married a person called Antonio Bologna, who is the person who is named in this play as the husband. Now, the plot of this play is essentially the Duchess of Malfi is a wealthy widow, and she falls in love with her steward and bears him several children, and up against this is her almost incestuously mad brother, who decides that he wants to decide who she gets married to and who she should see, and basically plots against her and plots against him until everything comes about nastily. They use a soldier called Daniel de Pozzola, who is the as their sort of means of destruction, their weapon against him. Now, this has just opened at the Old Vic, starring Eve Best as the Duchess, and Mark Bonner as Bozzola, amongst other people. What did you think about this, Julie?
Well, I thought it was a fantastic production. I thought the acting was great, but the set was amazing when you went into the auditorium, and there's this kind of gilded set that becomes darker as the production goes on. I love the play anyway, but I was really impressed with this production. It really kind of kept you gripped, I felt.
Rev Stan, how did you feel about this?
Yeah, I loved it too. I agree. I think that the staging was absolutely superb. The lighting was particularly fantastic. It gave the whole stage this really atmospheric look. Lots of wonderful shafts of light, different shapes and dark corners for people to hide in. I loved Harry Lloyd as the brother with the incestuous feelings towards his sister. I mean, he was played played a sort of deliciously evil young brother, and I thought I he was a joy to watch. I mean, the whole cast was absolutely amazing. Mark Bonner, I could listen to him reciting Jacobean and probably Shakespeare as well with his lilting Scottish accent for hours on end. His delivery is absolutely incredible, and it has a very satisfying bloody ending, as good Jacobean tragedy should, and great to see stage blood back at the Old Vic, because they were a bit bereft of that for Richard III, which I was a bit disappointed about. But no, the stage blood, they found a vat of it in the cellar, presumably, and it's back. So no, I thought it was a great production. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think they did some of the scenes really well as well, like the echo scene. It was just fantastic, and it was really moving, where Antonio thinks he hears the voice of his wife in the echo, and she starts, in the voice warns him, and that was beautiful. And also the scene where they get discovered, where they've gone out of the room, the servant and Antonio leave the room, and the Duchess is talking to herself, but Ferdinand has kind of creeped up. That is so kind of tense, that scene, and I thought that was excellent the way they did that.
Mm.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. This was a very nice production and very well done. I do have a slight problem with Eve Best. That's my problem, I think. It's just that I don't particularly like her as an actress. She is a very fine actress, it has to be said, but it's just that there's something about her. It's a kind of, I don't know, emotional coldness, as if she's manipulating it, and as if she doesn't really mean any of it, which I'm picking up on. I'm probably completely wrong, but it is just something that once you get that in your head, it's very difficult to shake, and you sort of look for it and don't concentrate on her performance, which is it has to be said, it sort of objectively is probably very, very good, and as you say, as I said before, Mark Bonner as an actor, it's interesting. We saw another early Jacobean play, "Tis Pity She's a Whore," recently. And again, a servant doing all the murders. I don't know what this says about Jacobean society or something like that.
James, well, it was the road as well, where you've got De Flores is a similar character to Bosler, and he's the kind of one that's doing all the kind of killing, and it's quite kind of grotesque as well, isn't it? That kind of character.
I think it was a time of great turmoil as well. You've obviously got the James I, and changing. A lot of things were changing in England at the time. I know there was a lot of turmoil, so, and they had to be very careful about what they wrote about. So there's a lot of subtext and historical subtext going on. So maybe that's where all the murderous servants is coming from. It's the underclasses rising up against the aristocracy.
And you can hide in the corners. Mm. You know, people can spy, and servants are spying, and you never know who's watching and who's to trust. And I thought that's one of the things the set did really well. Like you said, people could be watching or hiding, and other characters wouldn't see them in this kind of vast, vast set. And also, I think with The Changeling, you've got, which was down the road, just a month ago, wasn't it, at the Young Vic, you've got that sense of the madness as well, the kind of who's mad, the mad people who are in the cells around Malfi, or Ferdinand, you know, these kind of comparisons about different madness, or Bosler, who's killing everybody because he's angry at the way he's being treated. So there's all these kind of different comparisons going on as well, which I think are fantastic. And the psychological torture as well as the kind of physical torture.
I think it was mentioned in the programme about things like honour killings and forced marriages and stuff like that, which is a worry these days. And I don't think it was over... I don't think we really felt that in this production. Mm-hmm. But did anybody else notice that?
No, I didn't. I mean, it's the opposite in a way, because Ferdinand doesn't want her to marry at all, does he? Because he's the one that actually wants to kind of protect her or keep her in one kind of way. So it's kind of his desires, really, that you see at play here. And I think he's kind of the sense of them being twins as well, because I think they're twins, and he's the really evil one and she's the really good one. And so there's a kind of calmness about her at times as she kind of stands up to him. At first she's kind of spooked a little bit, but she stands up to him and she doesn't want to die, does she? So you've got these two comparisons between the brother and sister going on.
I must admit, somebody told me a few days later about them being twins. I was a bit taken aback because I must have missed that line in the play where you discover that, and I thought that was on slightly odd casting having those two, if you're to believe that they are twins, because he's obviously a lot younger than Eve Best. But yeah. I didn't realise that they were, so it didn't have any impact. But I know talking to some other people that have seen it, they had real problems with that.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that, because they weren't alike at all, were they?
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you, and goodbye.